pioneering missions to restricted access countries. I began my missionary work on this motorbike, this 250cc off-road scrambler, leaving from Cape Town all the way up to Mozambique, cross-country, into Ambush Alley, places like this, to countries where the bridges were mostly blown out, but there were no signs warning you that bridge out. You just had to have good brakes and be very observant. Mozambique back in 1982 was a communist country. It was a country where no missionaries were allowed, no one under 18 allowed in church. Propaganda was all over the place, including garbage like this. Samora Machel never walked in the streets holding little kiddies' hands. He came roaring in, motorbike outriders riding in the gutters, forcing people to dive out the way as came through at 80 kilometers an hour in his bulletproof vehicle with all the windows up and tinted windows. So, you know, this sort of propaganda thing is completely divorced from reality. They called Mozambique a developing country. Well, the only thing developing was rust and death and decay and weeds and thousands of kilometers of roads and railways suddenly just turned to nothing. The factories were socialized and nationalized. The cities were wrecked. In fact, landmines became the national plant. The missionaries had to design a new kind of vehicle, a tricycle for the people that could be hand-pedaled for people who'd lost their legs to landmines. There were so many landmines in the country. The communists brought weapons in. I saw their warehouse-type ships coming in, cargo ships, offloading tanks, trucks, helicopter gunships, weapons of all sorts. And those same ships left low in the water. What was that poor, starving country exporting? Food. They were exporting food from Mozambique while the people died of starvation. 1 million people died of starvation in what the BBC called Africa's forgotten famine. A green country. A country that turned back to cannibalism under Samora Machel while they burned Bibles, machine gun congregations. I documented huge amounts of atrocities in my Killingfields, Mozambique book. Renamed the anti-communist guerrillas were in many cases ex-Frelimo soldiers who used to fight for the communists and now were fighting against the communists. Alfonso de la Cama, on the motorbike here, was the head of Renamo when I went in. He used to be an officer in Frelimo, used to fight the Portuguese, and he said, the revolution has been betrayed. We've exchanged Portuguese colonials for Russians, and the Russians are worse. Where did they get their weapons from? The enemy is my quartermaster. They captured like 14.5 anti-aircraft guns. This is the enemy. Frelimo, these commies were on this tank protecting this radar station on top of the hill. It was on the Barra corridor. And when I pulled out my camera, they told me you couldn't take a picture of the radar station. So I asked if I could take a picture of them, and they said yes. And I angled it in such a way and moved so that I could get the radar station as well. Some Portuguese scripture gift mission literature in their hands. This man was actually, João was a communist. He was trained at Patrice Lumumba University in Moscow to be a communist terrorist, was converted to Christ, became one of our evangelists. Here you can see I'm with another man who'd been trained in Russia, and he is also Patrice Lumumba University graduate, but he became another one of our evangelists. This is one of my motorbikes, actually my second motorbike. This is a 500cc off-road motorbike, if anyone who's paying attention. And you can see the saddlebags. Each saddlebag could take a 5kg World Missionary Press Gospel booklet in Portuguese or Shangon. And that's an 80-liter backpack that packed just about everything I needed. And you might notice that I had brown hair on this occasion. I realized that I looked too blonde, and so to blend in, I thought, let's dye my hair brown. And, well, that still didn't blend in too much. And I asked the people why it was that nobody bothered me, because I expect to get into trouble very quickly. You know, South African, Mozambique, communist country, missionary, illegal. And they said, well, you obviously don't look Portuguese. So they assumed that you must be East German. And the East Germans run the secret police, the Stasi. So because the Stasi were running secret police, nobody bothered me. And I was getting away with the most outrageous things, showing the Jesus film in, I went to the city and set up my 60mm projector, was showing films, and I had hundreds of people seeing the gospel presented, sometimes thousands at a single meeting. There was one meeting where we had 2,200 at Jesus Film showing. And at the end, I saw people coming forward in camouflage with AKs, and I thought, I'm in trouble. They knelt down, they put their guns down, they prayed for the Lord to forgive them, and I baptized communist troops there. So, extraordinary experiences. I might add that the people in Mozambique were being shipped off to Cuba as slave labor. So this young man is being conscripted to go to work in the sugarcane plantations in Cuba because he had no choice. Because the Cubans weren't burning down the villages and killing the people for free. The people had to ship tens of thousands of the youngsters to go and work in their factories and on their sugarcane plantations to pay for the Cubans who were destroying their country. So I said to the pastor, that's terrible. And he said, no, don't cry for us. We were selfish people. We never prayed for anyone else. We never did anything. We never took the gospel to our neighbors. Now God is judging us, and rightly. But now we train all our members to be missionaries. And when it comes for man that he has to go to Cuba, we bring him before the church and we commission him as a missionary. And we lay our hands on him and we say, we command you, take the gospel of Jesus Christ to Cuba. And he said, how many pastors have the privilege of having 20% of the members on the foreign mission fields of the world, and the communists pay to get them there? So we've had the privilege of winning people to Christ. This woman from a Yao background, Muslim background, counseled by Martha, one of our missionary workers, to the Lord and given a Bible. This is a typical school in Mozambique. No desks, no benches. They're sitting on little poles. And they had chalkboard and chalk, no books, no pens or pencils, nothing like that. So we took in the chalk, we took in textbooks, Bibles, and they said to us, the Bible will be our textbook. This is the greatest book ever written. One of our missionaries, Lynn, she's now got five children of her own, married to one of our missionaries. She was my secretary at one time. She went all the way up to Zambia, and they've been for 22 years up in Mbala, which is right the southernmost tip of the Lake Tanganyika. In fact, Toby, you were with them, weren't you? Right, and so they're doing well. Five children, isn't it? So Grant and Lynn, Grant recruited them from South African Reconnaissance Commander, one of the recce's. Lynn was Cape Townian, and they've stood in the field in a very remote area and doing a sterling work. And in many of the villages, we'd go into a village and we'd see maybe 10% men, 30% women, 60% children. Where are the men? Well, they've either been killed or conscripted into either the army of the government or the concentration camps or to slave labor in Cuba, or they've joined the resistance to fight there. So you wouldn't see young men in a village. In 1989, I was captured by Russian forces, put in MI-8 helicopters like these. These weren't the two helicopters we were captured in, but they're identical to the ones that we were captured in, up in Tet province, and flown to interrogation first in Tet and later in Maputo and Mashava security prison. So every now and then we would make the headlines. Over the years, over 20 frontline missionaries have been in prison, and I've been involved in three of those incidents. And when I was captured in Mozambique, that was quite a case. They had all sorts of things like captured by Filimo and Baptist ministers, Filimo's top captive, and all that sort of thing. So these are just newspaper attacks on us at different times when we were locked up. And I've put some of these in the Killing Fields of Mozambique book. In fact, just an example of the difference between the British and the Americans. I have a British passport as well as a South African passport because my father fought all 6 years in the Second World War in the Eighth Army. So I have the privilege of a British passport, which I never liked, but it's certainly been very, very useful in missions. So after a week of abuse at the hands of the security forces in Maputo, SNASP security police, I was dragged in, for example, to one interrogation, and this man says, as I walk in, I am the devil, he said. what do you say to that? So I said, well, I'm a Christian. And he spat out such hatred. I hate Christians. That's a bit of a conversation stopper. He then ranted and raved about how Jesus was the first communist and the early Christians were all communists. And this is what the Bible teaches, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. I said, well, actually, that's what Karl Marx taught, from each according to his ability to each according to his need. Not that he ever did a day's work in his life. And I start to point out there's a big difference in the book of Acts between voluntary generosity and giving and compulsory communist confiscation and taking. It's a big difference between me saying what's mine is yours and sharing, and someone else coming saying what's yours is mine and taking. He said communism and Christianity are actually opposed. And anyway, if you believe that Christianity was communism and Jesus the first communist, why do you ban Bibles? Why do you burn churches? Why do you lock up missionaries like ourselves? And he went into a tirade against Margaret Thatcher, who was the prime minister in Britain at the time. It's 1989. And what an evil woman Margaret Thatcher was because of her capitalism and so on. Of course, he'd always spit out capitalism. So I responded with a lecture on the French Revolution and on the contrast between the Reformation and Revolution. And we kept swapping lectures for hour after hour. And I could see the clock behind them moving because they're taking away watches. And I could see we'd been there 6 hours. And during that time, he had not even asked my name. He had just so caught up in giving me lectures about communism and so on. And after 6 hours, he declared the interview over and sent me back to my cell. And I thought, well, that's pretty good. I mean, I can swap lectures for hours and days with communists. It's a lot better than having your fingernails ripped out and being charged with electricity. In the same room where he had dragged me in, there was armchairs with leather straps for the legs and for the arms. That's not good. And batteries, like car batteries, with electric wires with crocodile clips. And it looked like hardware store of tools on the table. So obviously a place for interrogations. So people who think it's not important to know your history, communists are always interested in history. If you can't debate for hours a communist on the matter of history and economics and so on, you might be finding yourself being tortured. So I think it's a very good motivation to pay good attention to history. I should say, when we were finally released, it was intriguing from pressure and protest, and our missions contingency plans went to high gear. There's protests outside the Mozambique embassy in England and America and so on, and Germany. And I just shortly before been on speaking tours all over, including in Frankfurt and in London and in Washington, D.C. So we had friends who were putting a lot of pressure on the government in Mozambique to release me. And so the day came, I was there with, there was six Americans, American medical people who are taken on their first visit to Africa, their last visit to Africa too. They asked me to give them an introduction. I don't think they've ever come back since. And they've never been in touch with us since. They're so traumatized. But on the day when we were marched into an office, and in the office there was this very glamorous-looking blonde woman in suit who shouted out, well, who are the Americans? And six hands went up, and hugging them, lots of shrieks and excitement, and with her arms around, went down the hallway giggling and so on, and saying, let's get you back to the American embassy for a shower and hamburgers and something like that. And then there's a man wearing a pinstripe suit, said, and who's the British gentleman? I was the only person not wearing camouflage and carrying an AK-47, but anyway, I raised my hand. He shook my hand. He said, had a spot of bother, have you? Well, let's get you to the embassy for a cup of tea. I thought, that's the difference between Americans and the British. Well, my second major mission field was Angola. We first saw Angola in the South African Army, and this country was once a paradise, but the communists destroyed it. The Portuguese built it up in 500 years, and the communists destroyed it in less than one. Here you can see Russian gas trucks with 75mm howitzers being pulled behind them. They were the enemy. Well, our way of getting in was normally with the watus, these hollowed-out tree trunks, these canoes. And you can see, recognize the World Missionary Press Gospel booklets, 5 kilos, and then you also see Heart of Man from the All Nations Gospel Publisher Scripture Gift Mission. That was the bulk of the materials we were taken in. And of course, to cross the river, you had to get past the flat dogs, crocodiles who were patrolling. And there were times that we were actually quite stuck in the swampy areas. Here's a couple of our missionaries wandering around, and the locals came along on a watcher and said, "Are you lost? Can we assist you? Are you missionaries?" Well, of course they're missionaries. Who's going to be wading around in a swamp there in the middle of nowhere? Yeah, this is walking into Angola. You can kind of see. I just swum the river in there. You can see my 9mm in hand. We'd swum the river in boots and all, and at the other side, infiltrated our way into Angola. First thing we start to see in Angola was very religious people. They worshipped the Trinity, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Vladimir Lenin. As I pointed out to them, these three men have one thing in common, they're all dead. Agostinho Neto was the dictator of Angola when we began this work, and Agostinho Neto said that, "I've destroyed the Bible," he said. "In 10 years' time, you'll have to go to a museum to see what a Bible looks like. I've destroyed the Bible. There won't be a Bible left on the face of Angola except in a museum in 10 years' time." Well, he said that back in about 1976. And we have smuggled in more Bibles into Angola than there were in Angola before he made that false prophecy. This Agostinho Neto claimed that Angola would be for the triumph and the extension of the revolution throughout Africa. This, by the way, is in Huambo, the second largest city in Angola. And this is a UNITA soldier. These are UNITA soldiers. And that's a UNITA flag. Red, green, red. And this city had fallen to the freedom fighters, UNITA freedom fighters. So much for Neto's prophecies. But the 600-odd industries and factories in the country that were nationalized were all in ruins in a matter of months. The bus service was also nationalized. The train service was also nationalized, and you could see the country is in such a mess that about the only way you could transport anything was on your bicycles, if you had a bicycle. They could load a lot in a bicycle. This, if you can read carefully, Banco Nacional de Angola. You could say socialism broke the Bank of Angola. This is a functioning bank. This bank was actually operational. And here they are in Huambo, walking with buckets of water in the city. You'd almost think it's like Cape Town. The largest city after Luanda, the second largest city in Angola, no water. Everyone had to walk and carry the water in buckets. And here you can see people walking with crutches or being pushed in wheelchairs because landmines were the national plant in Angola. UNITA freedom fighter Jonas Savimbi, who was trained in Red China, said, "I learned from the Chinese how to fight a guerrilla war, and I also learned how not to run a country." He became a pro-Western, Christian, anti-communist, and led the UNITA freedom fighters fighting against the communists. You can see quite a lot of their weapons and uniform outfits came from South Africa. And I had the opportunity of preaching to them, and my interpreter here. Interestingly, you'll notice some of my pictures are black and white and other pictures are color. And the reason for that is because when we were starting our work in the 1980s, color pictures were, you'd get slides for color pictures. For print, for newsletters, you'd get black and white because I'd never imagined the day would come that you'd have color newsletters. Just color print was unthinkable, the expense. So we would have black and white print and we would have color slides. And so that's why, depending on what was in my camera at the time, some things are in black and white and some things are in color. Jonas Savimbi, you notice this man has lost his left hand, chopped off by the communists. They knew what they were fighting for. And we had the opportunity of ministering to UNITA freedom fighters. Jonas Savimbi gave us full freedom. Once Jonas Savimbi said to me, "Do you know why there hasn't been a revolution in America in over 200 years? Yes. "No, I don't know." "America doesn't have an American embassy," he says. The American embassy is always involved in revolutions in the countries. Even in South Africa, they were heavily involved in promoting revolution. He said, "It's better to be America's enemy than America's friend. If you're America's enemy, you'll probably be bought. But if you're America's friend, you'll certainly be sold. America betrays its friends, aids its enemies." Sadly, that's true. This man lost his left leg to a landmine. This man also lost his left leg to a landmine. Can you imagine a medical facility that's made of thatched roof and thatched sides? Not very easy to be hygienic in that situation. UNITA, preaching amongst them, radio station, ministered in their radio freedom before as well. Jonas Savimbi was finally assassinated by, we think it could have been Spetsnaz, but they were hired by the American Gulf Chevron oil company because they didn't like the fact that UNITA Freedom Fighters were interfering with their business with a communist country. These are weapons captured by South Africans from the communist and given to the enemy, given to UNITA Freedom Fighters to use against the enemy. Here you can see the tag still on this brand new RPG and 14.5 anti-aircraft guns. You can see even the way of marching taught by the South Africans. So we ministered amongst them and performed chaplaincy services. We were with them in the field. We traveled with UNITA far and wide, and there were times that we came under aerial bombardment. In fact, back in 1986, we'd just been strafed, shelled, and just quite a day. We're sitting in the dark in the bush, glad that the enemy at that stage didn't have night fighting capabilities. You could have bushfires at night. You didn't need to worry. The bombing was only during daytime. And so we're sitting there around a campfire with my old, what we called fire bucket, end of a bayonet over the fire, boiling water for hot chocolate. And we're listening to shortwave radio, BBC World Service. And on the BBC World Service, who would come on but Ronald Reagan, President of the United States of America. And he said, we are going to send Stinger missiles to the UNITA Freedom Fighters in Angola. And I must say, I was shocked, and we were all shocked. And we were, it was unreal, because here we're in what the Portuguese called the ends of the earth, Cabo Kabanga province, at the uttermost parts of the earth, most remote place imaginable, and the American president's talking about us, UNITA Freedom Fighters, in Angola, and he's talking about our most perceived priority need, Stinger missiles, anti-aircraft missiles. And after long silence, somebody said, well, that would be nice, but will they do it? Indeed, they did. And here are some pictures of Mi-24 hand helicopter gunship shot down. This is a Stinger missile hit. One Mi-24 totaled. A MiG totaled. And other planes shot down by other different means over the years. And so, Ronald Reagan sent Stinger missiles to help the UNITA Freedom Fighters in Angola. That's correct. He was for the good guys. It was nice to have an American president who actually was anti-communist, because America's had a lot of low-life scumbag presidents like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Jimmy Carter and Clinton and Obama who've done everything they can to help the communists betray their people. Are you going to ask a question?
How did you get there?
How did we get there? Yeah. Yes, well, we swam, we walked, we used dugout canoes, we went from Namibia, sometimes we actually even went from Zambia, but that was more complicated, to get into UNITA Freedom Fighter territory. And of course, we developed relationships and friendships. And so over the years, it became easier. Sometimes we actually even flew. There were times that we actually had chartered aircraft and would go into a little jungle airstrip to reach them and, of course, smuggling in Bibles, books, medicines, and all this, preaching with them. But, it was, there were times that we went in, we had no contact. We just observed for 24 hours a border crossing point from a camouflaged up position from Namibian Southwest African side. Swam in when we knew there was no patrols, and walked in and found our way until we found some UNITA Freedom Fighters, convinced them we were good guys, and it took time to get all the way up to the top, and we met the leaders, and after a while, we had proper invitations. Of course, we came bearing gifts, which is important. Exterior decorating by Gorbachev and Sons. Your home, too, can look like this. Phone 1-800-MARXISM. Here you can see where the RPGs went through. You can see the AK shots. You can see the big ones, which came from 50 cals or for the communists, that would be the 12.7s, basically. And, yeah, so the joy of shooting up these places. This is the main road. If you look at our maps, Michelin maps at the time, thick red line, looked like a major road. You get there and it's like, where is the road? It took imagination to work out where the road was. You're looking here and you can see, okay, there's more trees here, there's less here, this must be the road. The road is so overgrown. That's why I said when they called it a developing country, anything developing was weeds. This Land Rover of ours, we spent more time under the hood than we did behind the wheel driving it, fixing it. And sometimes we even reduced down to having ox-drawn sleds because the vehicles could not travel in such sandy roads. We had to literally drag Bibles. We're talking about Bibles, latter half of the 20th century, being pulled on ox-drawn sleds and often being carried. We'd recruit people. It was like David Livingstone era. Porters, box the Bibles and heads, each person having about 20 kgs. As you can see, this is about the equivalent of 4 World Missionary Press Gospel booklets in one box there. So an average of 20 kgs each person's carrying on their head. And as you can see, Bibles. That would be a 20 kg box right there. And sometimes you'd see a man and his wife and baby walking on areas where landmines are the national plant. We'd get to some clinics, and these clinics would be very excited when we brought them some quinine, antiseptics, antibiotics, creams, bandages, and so on. And they sometimes had a ceremony to formally open the clinic then, which had been closed for lack of materials. And what a shamefully small selection. I mean, we felt embarrassed that we'd brought them so little, but that was enough for them to reopen their clinics in some cases. Here, disposable gloves being washed again and again. This doesn't look very good, but actually it's worse than it looks because most of those boxes are empty. But this is the pharmacist showing us what they had at the main hospital at Jumbo, the headquarters of UNITA Freedom Fighters. So this is one shipment where we brought in medicines and a lot of very good high-tech weaponry for medical people. This is the skeleton staff of the medical school that had training there. And some of the operations being carried out in less than ideal circumstances, but some of this equipment was organized by my mother-in-law, who is a nurse, Harriet Bathman, and we had the chance of taking them in. They reached the stage where, with South African doctors' help, they were doing some advanced surgery. We're talking about at the Rebels Freedom Fighter headquarters in Jumba. Look at one church service, and the amount of people on crutches. They had 85,000 cripples in Angola from landmines at one stage. I got that stat. They had more landmines than people. They had a population of 5 million at the time, with 10 million landmines in the country planted. Enough to have 2 landmines per person. And you can imagine in situations like this how bad their Bibles are. Now, this is the pastor's wife, and she's showing the one Bible they had left, which is actually in a shameful condition. We saw how they did their offerings. The offerings were people bringing bits of corn and so on. They didn't have anything else. And this church is the Reformed Church, which on a previous mission, our team had heard sing A Mighty Fortress, celebrating 31 October 1517. And this was a 1994 picture. And they inspired us to start our Reformation days, which we've been doing now for the last 25 years, every end of October. This church, a Reformed church, their building had been destroyed, so they were gathering under the trees. They were not allowing the inconvenience of not having a building keep them from their priority of worship. We brought in the communion equipment. That asked on a previous mission for us to please bring in communion materials, and so we managed to donate to them these little glasses and holders, and I think they felt very excited about that. These Sunday school materials are from Carver, in Portuguese, of course, and we had some in Ovumbundu. Here, one of the church members with a Bible in the Ovumbundu language. This woman said, "This is the greatest gift anyone could have asked for, the word of God in my own language. One of our missionaries, Anthony Duncan, there's pictures on the wall below the clock over there. Anthony Duncan died in the service of Christ back in 1994, the worst month in Frontline's history. We sent, end of November, 4 vehicles into the field and only one vehicle came back. Now, one of the vehicles was being donated to a ministry in Zambia, so fair enough, but another vehicle was basically shot up and destroyed in an ambush with UNITA Freedom Fighters on the way back from Angola. Anthony was part of a team that had succeeded in smuggling a ton of Bibles and books in the Land Rover you saw a picture of earlier, which actually got shot up, this Land Rover. So this Land Rover was basically totaled, not able to be brought back from the field. And this had done quite a lot of missions before that. So they succeeded in delivering a ton of medicines and Bibles into the UNITA Freedom Fighter areas. But on the way back, coming into Caprivi, they were machine gunned up by SWAPO, attacked and imprisoned. Now, I was in the only vehicle that did get back from that mission in Zambia, running a biblical worldview seminar in Lusaka, when I got the word from Cape Town that we didn't have a single missionary or staff member in our base in Cape Town in 94. Everyone was in the field. We had a few part-time volunteers. So one part-time volunteer got the news about the arrest, managed to get a message to me. Of course, that's before cell phones. Had to go and try and find somebody at a phone that hadn't been disconnected for lack of payment in Zambia. We were speaking on the radio and TV, Zambia National Broadcasting, and we found out that, none of their phones worked because they'd been disconnected for non-payment. So even the National Broadcasting Service didn't have a working telephone. When I phoned back and I learned what was going on, the timing was good. Because at that moment that our team was arrested in Namibia for illegally crossing the border into Angola, the Angolan Freedom Fighters, UNITA, and the Angolan government were sitting at a table in Lusaka, hosted by the Zambian president, Frederick Chiluba, who was at that moment chairing to try and bring these two forces together for a peace treaty. And when we got the word to him, he gave the order that you release these missionaries or these talks are over. And you may wonder how we had that contact with the Zambian government. I'll give more details about that tomorrow under What Can Go Wrong on a Mission, because I'd been locked up in prison with the future government of Zambia. The people who were the president and vice president of Zambia at that time used to be in the same cell as me in 1987, but now we're talking about 1994, and they'd come to power in 1991. In Africa, yesterday's prisoners can be tomorrow's president, so these are the things that could go on. On the way back from that phenomenal, complicated mission, which is documented in Angola by the back door, written by my father-in-law, Bill Bathman, Anthony Duncan was killed in head-on collision. After driving through the night, this is after surviving the mission, surviving the arrest, the imprisonment, everything else. And he died on the way back from that mission in a head-on collision, driving through the night. A Merc overtaking a truck. Not too far from south of Springbok, basically not too far from Fredendal, that sort of area. In South Africa. Close to home, yeah. Yes. The driver survived. Anthony, the passenger, did not. I should say something more about Anthony. Anthony was South African infantry. He survived contacts with terrorists. He was a game ranger in the Tosha Game Reserve in the anti-poaching unit. He, with bolt-action rifle, beat terrorists with AK-47 automatic assault rifles in protecting animals. He was once trampled into the mud by a rhino that he was trying to rescue. And survived. He was charged by two lion at one point, and although he had a revolver and rifle, he put the rifle down and threw stones at the lions, because like myself, he's a serious animal lover and he couldn't bring himself to shooting a magnificent lion. He once came off his motorbike at 160 kilometers an hour. It's 100 miles an hour, 160 kilometers an hour, into a mealy patch and survived. So Anthony, we used to say Anthony's got more lives than a cat. He is aged 28 when he died, and there was a few extraordinary things about this. One was, of all the people in our mission, here's the most spiritually minded, and here's the most eager to be with the Lord. Seriously. Talk like this, and we used to think, this chap is actually very heavenly minded, to the point that we kind of thought he was a bit crazy. He's the most spiritually minded person on our mission. I trust we're all ready to meet the Lord, but he is actually eager. So, I often change routes for no reason, except that nobody knows what our teams are doing exactly because of security. So while the team would have normally gone up through Botswana or Zimbabwe, what he is doing, because he first had to go to Zambia and deliver one vehicle before going on to join up with the team to Namibia. I sent him at the last minute through Namibia, up the N1, N7, A1, and then Caprivi to go into Zambia, and then he later came back. And that was the way I was going to send him up. And then I, at the last minute, sent him through the Pretoria route. And what I didn't know was his mother and father were divorced, and his brother, his mother, father, sister were all not walking with the Lord. And so Anthony, on the way up, had the chance to meet with each of his family members, speak to them, counsel them, rebuke them. Of course, they didn't listen to him then. But when he died, and I had to phone the family and tell them, you can imagine they all broke down. And at his funeral in Cape Town, his family members were reconciled with one another and with the Lord. Interesting. There was so much that came out of this, but I couldn't have known all these aspects. All of this came out only around the funeral later. But this was a mission and a half. I first heard of our team being arrested, managed to get them out within a day. The very next day, I'm hearing that Anthony's died head-on collision on the way back out. And I'm still in Zambia. And our team had to, our vehicle was the only vehicle left that had to pick up the survivors of our mission all over, driving through Botswana, through Namibia, picking up, even had to take the trailer of one of the vehicles and put it on the roof. So we had a trailer. There's another trailer on top of the roof of our bucky. We had seven people in our bucky coming back to South Africa. That was a bad day. Colonel Jan Breitenbach, the most colorful character in South Africa's history. Colonel Jan Breitenbach is the founder of the South African Reconnaissance Commando 3-2 Battalion. He's such a wild character. This man was in Nigeria fighting for the Biafrans in the Biafran Civil War in 1967-1970. He was in the last plane out of Uli. If you've seen Dogs of War film, and this DC-3 taking off with everything breaking around, bursting around, all hell breaking loose on the airstrip, that actually was modeled on Colonel Breitenbach's experience in Uli, flying out of Uli. He was on the last plane out of Uli as the federal forces overran it. And so the book is based in Nigeria, whereas in the film they just made it American mercenaries and threw it into Central America. But Colonel Breitenbach is quite a character. He went into Angola during the Civil War and recruited thousands of ex-communist, Portuguese-speaking black Angolans to fight for South Africa. Welded them into the Buffalo Battalion, 3-2 Battalion. And he founded 44 Parachute Battalion. He led the largest airborne assault in the history of Africa, the Battle Kasinga, 1978. And he was wounded in that attack, but they completely obliterated the SWAPO headquarters and high command. When he retired from the army, he joined our mission. And I had the privilege of traveling with him. He spoke at several of our training courses. 1994, he was a guest speaker at our Biblical Worldview seminar that we had in Glenville. So Colonel Breitenbach, an absolute wild man. He had lions and a leopard as pets, not cubs. Full-grown, real thing. Absolutely wild, wild, wild person. And boy, you have quite an experience traveling with him. Well, in 1989, as the South Africans were preparing to leave Southwest Africa, we went on a speaking tour throughout the whole country. We spoke to all from the general in charge of Southwest Territorial Force, General Maring, all the way down to the lowest troop in every place, in the rain, so on. Well, after a month of preaching multiple times a day, we had had over 90 meetings in the previous month. Colonel woke up one morning, looked up from a sleeping bag to me and said, Peter, let's go preach to the communists today. And we did. We walked across the border post. This is one border post. You can see not everyone used passports to cross. We went and we preached to these people, the communists, MPLA or FAPLA. They were the forces of the communist MPLA movement. And this is just one of the few pictures that I've ever got of the day. Colonel Breitmark sitting under the tree there, and I'm preaching through interpreter. And we went from one place to the other. And Colonel Breitmark, we flew to three different locations in Angola, and with Portuguese-speaking 3-2 battalion translators, we preached to the commies. And Colonel Breitmark gave a message I'd never forget. Every word is burned into my memory. It was so shocking. I'm Colonel Jan Breitmark, he said, of 3-2 battalion. My men and I, we've killed thousands of you communists. Thousands. We never had any trouble killing you. Our trouble was catching you. You ran so fast. You broke Olympic records running away from the fight. Even when you outnumbered us 10-1, you ran like the yellow-bellied, spineless cowards you are. You're afraid to die. And you should be afraid to die. Because you don't have any belief in God. No, your God is Karl Marx. Your religion is atheism. Your commissars are the priests of Satan. You're lost. You're damned. You're going to burn in hell forever. If you knew what was waiting for you the other side of the grave, you'd crawl across the minefield. You'd beg 3-2 battalion to show you the way of salvation, Jesus Christ. And he did this three times, different places. I gave my picture. And each time my hand went to my 9mm, and I thought the colonel wants the short way to glory. And I thought that I did not think we'd see the sunset that day. And it was extraordinary. And yet these commies, hundreds of these communists standing around with their weapons, fingering their weapons. I thought they are going to attack us for sure. I mean, you know, Colonel and I, 2 9mm between us, you know, really, it wouldn't take long. And yet we got away with it. And when we got home, we thought, boy, when I say home, back to Ruakana base, and, we got off the helicopter and the commandant came out and said, oh, Colonel, the lions have been humming today, all the way from Portugorta to Bastion. Bastion is headquarters in Vinthorpen, up to Sector 10 on Dangwa. And Pick Porter, he's a foreign affairs minister, is the Helen with you and Hammond, and we're told to expel you from the country forthwith. Now, Colonel Breitmark had fired the first shot to the wall in 1966. He had fought for the country 26 years against these communist scum, done more than any other single human being to fight the communists there, and now he is being expelled from the country for preaching the gospel and upsetting some commies. Well, apparently a whole lot of those commies were needing psychological counseling because they were traumatized by what the colonel and I said. Well, today you can go to Angola and you can see you won the war. That's the Lomba River. That's a MiG. Some places you can see the tanks are just there. There are hundreds of Russian armored cars, BRDMs, T-54s, all kinds of armored cars. This is just the wreckage of the war. You can Google Earth Lomba River and you can see still the armored cars and tanks where they got roasted by the South African Air Force or by our 61 mechanized battalion group or by G5s and G6s, the artillery barrages, absolutely annihilated. Hard and fast concrete, or should we say steel, evidence of the defeat of the Soviet Union in Angola. We've also pioneered a lot of work in Zimbabwe. Here's the Matopos. This was our bucky back in the 1980s, and little bucky, but we carried a lot in it. And here's some commie terrorist with the World Missionary Press Gospel tract in his hand. And at Birchenhof Bridge, these people told me I was not allowed to take a picture of the bridge, so we took a picture of them. And this chap had instructed me not to take a picture of the bridge, so asked if I could take a picture of him, and then asked him, move, and then, good, got your picture there too. Just to show what an idiot he was. And these are some terrorists on the hill. I managed to, Zimbabwe National Army, I mean, they call themselves an army, but they were just the ex-gooks or terrorists. And here they were making idiots of themselves. And this chap doesn't have a shirt because I always beret because I'd actually, for a digital watch that cost me R2 at Macro, I'd got him to sell his uniform and beret to me. Just some of the things we've got as souvenirs here. And these are some of the commies that we were witnessing to. So ill-disciplined, they even let me get hold of their rifle. It's just not clever. Well, we went back there with bigger vehicles. It's a 1600 Nissan Bucky. And with our good friend Bonali Ferry ministering in a country which was destroying the agriculture, destroying the white-owned farms. The ambulances couldn't go anywhere. The hospitals were in a mess. We got whole hospitals reopened with the medical materials we took through. The relief aid we took to people who are starving because of the national suicide of Zimbabwe. Boxes with love. At one stage, we let people produce their own boxes with love. But they were, as you could see, a bit of, well, who knows. So that's why we've made it more systematic. And we have a uniformed way to make sure that what the people say they're most in need of is packed, and we get these boxes with the 30, 40 different items that I get packed and transported from here all the way up to Zimbabwe to help our friends. We've written on Zimbabwe a lot. Zimbabwe's been one of our most important mission fields for years. But you can see the battles in Africa. The red men here represent where the wars are, and our war zones moved. So we started to move up. When the wars stopped in Angola, Southwest Africa, Mozambique, South Africa, 1994, because of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the defeat of the Soviets in Angola, the Cubans going back to their island, all the problems in Southern Africa started to unravel, and we found free elections for the first time in Zambia and so on. And so we were able to start looking further afield. And at that point, the Holocaust had broken out in Rwanda, 1994. So I went up there. I didn't have money for it, didn't have a vehicle. So I cashed in my frequent flyer miles and got a free ticket to Nairobi, hitchhiked through to Rwanda with a couple of hundred Bibles in Kini Rwanda and French. And then after that, I hitchhiked through to Sudan. Didn't have a vehicle. Basically went in on what vehicles would give me a lift and walked around, and that was the beginning, 1995, our work in South Sudan. So this gives you an idea of the spiritual battle in Africa. The green is where Muslims are the majority. The yellow where witchcraft is the majority. And the crosses where over 20% of people are evangelical Christians. This is a more scientific map. We did this map. But this is a more scientific map done by Operation World, Patrick Johnson. Showing where you can see the bright yellow is where the highest percentage of Christians are, the bright blue where the highest percentage of animists are, and the bright green where the highest percentage of Muslims are. That gives you a bit of an idea of the spiritual battle in Africa. The missionaries in the 19th century had a strategy of putting a line of mission stations across the south of the Sahara to keep Islam north and to prevent Islam from taking the animist tribes in the south. And it was very successful for a century. But 1960, most of those mission stations were closed down. The missionaries were withdrawn. And you can see how Islam has seeped further south as a result of abandoning that very effective missionary strategy of the 19th century. In the Middle East, Sudan is part of the Muslim Middle East. This is Al-Tarabi, the sort of spiritual godfather of Islamic terrorism. He has birthed a radical Islamist revival in Sudan. And he's been a spiritual backing for Omar al-Bashir, war criminal, dictator of Sudan since 1989. Omar al-Bashir took power in a bloody coup of 1989, and he's bludgeoned all opposition down in this one-party state. Many Christians, including missionaries, have ended up in this National Supreme Court in Khartoum because they apply Sharia law. Christians get whipped for taking communion wine. It's against Sharia law to have wine. Christian women get whipped for not wearing an Islamic veil because it's not necessary in Christianity, but it is according to Sharia law, and so on. A South African photojournalist, Kevin Carter, flew up to Sudan and he took this picture in 1993. It became the Pulitzer Prize photograph of 1994. It's of a Sudanese girl, malnourished, so weak she can't rise, with a vulture behind her. Now, Kevin Carter was a South African photojournalist. He flew up to Sudan. He's only there for an hour. His chartered aircraft was waiting on the airstrip at a feeding center. He was about 300 yards from the feeding center, and he saw this little girl crawling towards the feeding center. He positioned himself in the shade of a tree, and he took a light ring, and he waited an hour. And when this vulture hopped in the background, he clicked the shutter, and he said, "I knew I had an award-winning picture." Now, he went to New York. He got this Pulitzer Prize, which is like the Academy Awards of Photojournalism, the top award a photojournalist can aim for. And then people start to ask difficult questions. What happened to the little girl in the picture? "Well, I don't know," said Kevin Carter. "Well, what's the story? How did you get the picture?" Well, he had flown in first time looking for photo op. They saw it crawling around. Took an hour, waited. "What did you do after you took the picture?" "Well," he said, "I sat under the tree and I smoked a cigarette. And I cursed God." Kevin Carter said he cursed God. All Kevin Carter took into Sudan was his cameras. All he brought out of Sudan was this picture. All he left behind Sudan was cigarette stubs. When you look at this picture, you think of the words of the Lord Jesus, Matthew 25, "Whatever you did not do unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you did not do it to me." Some people said, what's the difference between a vulture and a picture and a vulture behind the camera? Well, to speak in defense of the vulture in a picture, he's just cleaning up the wreckage of man's sin. The vulture behind the camera, though, is a wicked individual. By the way, Kevin Carter, shortly after he got his Academy Award, committed suicide in South Africa. Not a word of concern for the people he'd hurt and the things he hadn't done. Full of swear words, full of cursing against God. Not even concerned for his own child, who he said, well, he is 34. You couldn't expect him to be looking after a child of his. I mean, gee, you know, how unreasonable is that? So he is an illegitimate father. He didn't care. He is regularly on drugs. Quite a character. And to think that, and he is full of anger that people were judging him because he hadn't done anything to help this girl. And he says, you know, our job as journalists is just to record what happens. We're not meant to get involved. Well, shortly after that, I got involved going up to Sudan. And here you can see the biggest problem. The UN. This is Lokochokio, northernmost point in Kenya, site of Operation Lifeline Sudan. This is where the United Nations was running the biggest operation in the world at that time. And they controlled all access to Sudan. In fact, they were prolonging the war by taking, flying in supplies, keeping the besieged Muslim cities in the south supplied, and thereby prolonging the war. Because the whole point of a siege is to starve the enemy into submission. And, of course, by the UN flying in relief aid to the very Arabs doing the scorched earth, mind you, more than helping the people whose villages were being burnt down by the Muslims or being bombed by the aircraft in Juba, Malakal, and these other areas where the UN was supporting, effectively providing an efficient air force to help the Arabs in the name of helping people with starvation, but they're helping the people doing the starving rather than helping the people who are the victims. So I had to smuggle things through. My first attempt to fly in by charter plane into Sudan Bibles was cancelled by the UN. So I heard there's a British Sea Squadron, ex-Sea Squadron 22 SAS officer in charge of UN security. So I thought, this is good. Sea Squadron means he had served in Rhodesia. So I went up and identified myself as an ex-Rhodesian, and immediately there was broad smiles and chatting away, and found out we knew a whole lot of people. Do you know Schillies, Chris Schillenberg? Yes, and so on. Rhodesian Sea Squadron. And this Brit was very, I mean, it was like there's immediate bond because military knew one another's contacts and friends. I said, I've got a problem. Your people have cancelled flight clearance for my flight into Sudan. I need flight clearance. Not a problem, he says. Pulls out his pen, clipboard. What's your cargo? Bibles. Put his pen away. He looks at me in shock and said, Bibles? There's 14 helicopter gunships stationed in Juba. I know, I said, that's why I need the flight clearance. And he scowled at me and he says, you take off with Bibles, we will blow you out of the sky. And I said, you threatening my life because I'm taking Bibles in? Did the Blue Beret suck your brains out? You threatening my life for taking Bibles in? He said, it's against the law in Sudan. I said, I know. So is alcohol. And your planes are flying in whiskey for you and people inside Sudan, which is also against Sharia law. That's different, he says. I know it's different, I said. We're talking about Bibles here. And anyway, he would not change. I mean, the moment I mentioned Bibles, all camaraderie was off and it was hostility. Well, we still flew, and fortunately we found pilots who were willing to fly below the radar illegally. These are the kind of things we'd have to get past. In Juba and Malakal, you had these helicopter gunships, Hind helicopters, and these MiGs. And they would like to shoot us down. It's a shoot on site policy. We're flying very small little planes like Cessna caravans. And this is one of the first shipments of Bibles I smuggled into Sudan. You can see how tall the Dinka people are. Very tall people. Dinka Padang being smuggled in. Immediately we saw the churches being bombed. This was an Anglican church, Episcopal church, bombed by the Sudanese Air Force. There's something wrong when you've got supersonic jet fighters bombing wooden and thatched churches in the 21st century. Radical. Churches bombed. Graves desecrated. This is a jihad against Christians. Destroyed by helicopter gunships. Destroyed by helicopter gunships. Bombed by high-flying Antonovs. And during the dry season, it just, the whole bush catches fire. Kills wild animals, domestic animals, farms. Exterior decorating by Muhammad and Sons. Your farm too can look like this. The graves of the missionaries that planted the church at, this is the birthplace of Christianity in southern Sudan, Luy Cathedral. We were under fire. We were under bombing number of occasions. I've preached over 1,200 times in Sudan. I don't think I've ever preached in a church or a school that hasn't been bombed at least once. Sometimes we've been bombed 18 times. This church was bombed 10 times. The birthplace of Christianity in southern Sudan, in Luy. Jeffries Kianga and Vasco, two of our best co-workers over there, most faithful Anglican Episcopalian pastors who we help train and equip. I've had more service in Sudan in this church, Kotobe, than anywhere else, workshops, seminars, and conferences, and so on. After my first visit, destroyed by helicopter gunships, we came to run a Muslim evangelism workshop, and it was destroyed. Helicopter gunships had destroyed the church. These paths had walked for 30, 40, 50, sometimes 60 kilometers on foot to come to this conference. When they were there, they stood with their Christian flag in the ashes of their church, and they still wanted me to teach them how to win their enemies to Christ. Here are the people walking to church with their hat, their chairs on their head. Good hospitality over there is to show you where the bomb shelter is and to give you an AK-47. Now, not everyone is Christians. When we started work there, there was a lot of animism, a lot of paganism, like the Kasipa people, extended lips and ears. And you could see amongst the Dinka and Nuer and Shaluk people, many of the Nuer and Dinka still would be doing the scarification. And there was witch doctors, the people, they'd be using fish hooks to make these bumps and then rubbing ash into to create this permanent kind of body modification. And body painting amongst the Nuba tribes, very common, even to this day. Some places were swamp, like the Sud. You could take 4 days to cross the Nile at some place like where the Sud is. It's huge, huge, huge. Notice the crosses on top of quite a few of the people's huts. Okay, you can see the cross on top of that hut. By the way, this hut, you'd think, is that a church? No, actually, that's where they keep the cattle. The cattle have a better hut than the people. These people are Shaluk people, and this is an Upper Nile. They're mostly Presbyterians. And when did you last read Genesis and Exodus? The first time the people in this area, amongst these people, the Nuer in Upper Nile, read Genesis and Exodus. First time I read was 1995. And we sponsored and took in the books of Genesis and Exodus. And here, bringing Sunday school materials, catechisms, hymn books, Bibles to the moral people, in Moreland, Equatoria Province. Books for the teachers, for the school. Bibles for the school teachers, do training. Libraries for schools. And these pastors, between them, had about 120 congregations to care for. Some pastors had as many as 5 congregations to minister to, walking between the churches. Many churches, no buildings, meeting under the trees. And because the church building had been destroyed, their church services would be held in the forest. And this is the first conference that we held amongst the Moro people in the forest because the church building was destroyed by helicopter gunship attack. People carrying their own chairs to church. Just look at these pastors. Eager, tough. Look at this chap. His glasses broken. Notebook in his pocket. Pen there. Notebook open. Eager. Ready to learn. Walk for miles. Knew this chap well. And you may wonder how hot it is wearing a jacket. It's very hot, but the Moro expects you to wear a tie jacket. They are Anglicans, Episcopalians. They're formal, very formal. And their services are done with processionals, recessionals, and all. Moro Christians. Town hall, town elders at Cotterby. These are the bodyguards of the governor assigned to protect us when we were traveling around. And they were excited to see their stories and their testimonies in the newsletters. Where did they get their weapons from? The enemy is my quartermaster. Whatever they could capture from the enemy. These are some of the patrols. This is captured. I think this is East German Zoo, 23mm quads for anti-aircraft guns. I believe they captured those from the enemy. And definitely would have got from Soviet bloc or from Chinese. The bishop's house, bomb crater with some of the shrapnel in there. Our vehicle was bombed while traveling, and a bad idea. Team had the windows up, aircon on, and some music playing. And the first thing I knew of the explosion was the vehicle rocked off, then heard the afterburn of the MiG. The MiG had come low down and bombed. Vehicle got run off the road, fortunately not destroyed, but the soil was very clay. I think the bomb went in deep before it exploded. And so we survived, but you don't travel in a war zone with the windows up. You want to hear what's coming. But with these MiGs, they can be so fast, they can be faster than speed of sound that they're on you, and you'd only hear the jets' engines after you've had the explosion already. So that's bad. Sometimes you've got this kind of just terrain, open, and you feel very vulnerable to air attack. This was the border post into Sudan when we started our work. And the first thing you start to see, lots of shot out armored cars, vehicles, tanks. And this revolutionized your prayer life, because when you are traveling in a soft skin vehicle from Cape Town like this, and you can see the tanks didn't make it, you really want to know that you're right with God, and that you, you have your sins forgiven, you know? And the roads are pretty bad. In fact, this is why we have snorkels for our engines to breathe underwater, because the bridge has been blown up. You can actually see over here the remnants of the bridge blown up. So we're crossing the river I've driven with the water up to my chest height. I mean, it comes through the window and everything. And you've got to have all your literature waterproofed. And because the bad roads, shaky potholed roads, before crossing, you've got to recheck all the seals, the plastic trunks, the duct tape. You don't want any literature to get wet. It's already traveled 8,000 kilometers to get there. You've got to make sure it arrives dry. You can see the Arabic script. They tried to push Arabic on the local people. The SPLA, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, asked us, do the Christians in South Africa pray for us in Sudan? And I said, I'm afraid they don't even know you exist, but we will change it. And they said, we are a hidden people fighting a forgotten war. And they asked me, will you be our ambassador to speak up for us? We're holding the line against Islam. Indeed, they were. And it's so important. So I took these pictures. We got these published in military magazines all over the world, Christian magazines, that some of the first pictures people saw of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army were pictures that I took, 1995, 1996, 97, and spoke on hundreds of radio stations. I'd say I've spoken over 1,000 times on radio and TV worldwide, from as far afield as Canada to Australia, speaking up for the Sudanese and their fight for freedom against Islam. First chaplain service we ran for the SPLA in Sudan, 1996. Look familiar? Form evangelism in the field, absolutely vital. And you can see the idea of having people on both sides of the screen as well. We were, at this stage, the reason why the vehicle is so close, because the projector was running off the car battery. The first Jesus film in the Moro language ever shown. First film that ever had in Moro, for that matter. And we got that organized with the Jesus Film Project in Orlando and put them in touch with the Bible translators in Moroland, and they did the translation for them. The church that will not die, Fraser Cathedral, the church has been bombed 10 times, showing the Jesus Film there. This is the oldest man in the community that I know, Canon Ezra Lewiri. Sorry, this is Canon Reuben. Canon Reuben was in the Equatorial Corps, trained by the British. 1955, they fired the first shots of the war. The Arabs, as the British were leaving, the Arabs said to them, this even before the British had totally left the country, they ordered the Equatorial Corps to lay down their weapons and board the train unarmed and go to the north. And they said, we're not laying down our weapons. We know you Arabs. You've treated us as slaves all of our history. If we lay down our weapons, you're going to kill us or enslave us. And we're the guardians of the south. No, we won't do it. They were ordered. So they shot the Arab officers who were trying to disarm them. And they went in the bush, and that began Ananya One, or the first war of liberation. And he was one of them. He still got his beret from the Equatorial Corps. Well, he is helping to rebuild the church that's been destroyed by helicopter gunships. Ken Rubin, good evangelist, one of our good friends over there. While we were rebuilding the church at Cotterby, we rigged up a screen to show them this before we had those nice aluminium frame things that you've been practicing on. And we showed them the film Khartoum to encourage him. One of the people came to you afterwards and says, it seems to me that Gordon Pasha is Ben-Hur, because we've shown the Ben-Hur film, and said, very observant, and that's Charlton Heston, he's an actor. Now they were really confused. We've shown him a film on Ben-Hur, we showed them a film on Charles Gordon, Khartoum, and the same persons at both, and this required quite a lot of explanation. Once we rebuilt the church, we had to use plastic sheeting for the roof because it wasn't thatch season yet. And so we had to wait for the thatch to come in. But here it is with the thatch, the same church rebuilt. Just one of many examples of churches destroyed by the enemy rebuilt. Easter service in Sudan, year 2001. And Canon, this is Bishop Bulunduli here. Jeffrey Kianga, one of our most faithful translators and the first man who I trained for the ministry in Sudan there. They're under La Ro, the slave traders tree. Under this tree, the Arabs used to tether the people and take them off as slaves to Khartoum. You see the roof of the church behind? That church is the church that was destroyed 3 times, bombed 10 times, rebuilt every time. This is our frontline mission base at the Bishop Gwynne Bible College, which was where we had our first chaplain's conference. So there's a first chaplain's conference for the Sudanese People's Liberation Army. Chaplain John, Chaplain Moses, and equipping them with Bibles and Sunday school materials. We brought in bicycles to put wheels under the word. Chaplains being equipped with bicycles and Bible bags and boots and berets, produced the first chaplain's handbooks, chaplain prayer books, which have been upgraded and brought together. Sometimes we're able to charter a DC-3 aircraft. This is like Second World War vintage DC-3s. Sometimes we use Japanese Mitsubishis, like this one, to fly in tons of Bibles. Most times we went in by caravans, Cessna caravans. This is on one of my 27 missions into Sudan. And during this time, we smuggled in over 500,000 Bibles and Christian books in, was it 25 languages, something like that. DC-3s, turboprop conversion, ex-South African Air Force. This is World War II aircraft with turboprop conversion, still smuggling Bibles. This is the largest shipment of Bibles ever smuggled into the Islamic country up till this date. This is 1998. And it's a South African DC-3, South African Air Force, with a South African Air Force pilot, ex-South African Air Force pilot, retired, who's willing to risk his life and his license flying in illegally against the UN blockade. This is a Land Rover which we purchased in South Africa, equipped as a Land Rover, as an ambulance, and drove it into Sudan to be the ambulance for the hospital there. And this is 9,700 Bibles and New Testaments in 13 languages. Newly liberated airstrip. This airstrip had been under the control of the Arabs just a few months before. And this includes Pat Matriciana of Jeremiah Films. He came in and he did the Sudan Hidden Holocaust film and terrorism and persecution films in Sudan. Hymn books, catechism books, prayer books for the Moro people, the hymn book and prayer book combined, the Bible in Moro. Our biggest printing project to that date. You can see a copy in the reception area behind glass. This Bible was translated at first by the missionary general, Dr. Reverend Fraser, Kenneth Fraser. He had translated the Gospels and Acts into Moro. His disciple, Canon Ezra Lawiri, spent the rest of his life translating the rest of the Bible. This was completed in 1991. But Canon Ezra Lawiri was killed on the way to getting it published, and he said to his deacon, Bulunduli, who later was the bishop, "My work on earth is complete. See, this is published." And he died. Bulunduli was quite frustrated by the time he told us about this 9 years later. He's got the manuscript ready to be printed, but the Bible study says they don't have funds. Nobody's able to print it. They say the Moro people aren't big enough and so on. I said, we'll get it done. Don't know how, but anyway, our little mission based in Cape Town, we managed to get the first 10,000 printed and transported into Sudan. And here's the first 3,000. That is 3,000 Bibles. And 3,000 Bibles, each one's a kilogram. That's 3 tons. 3 tons of Bibles. 3 tons of Bibles flown in by DC-3. That's a lot of Bibles. And that's the church that will not die. Jeffrey Kyunga, again, key man. Kenneth Baringwa, the man who gave me the Macedonian call, who called me to, and this is Canon Reuben, good man. And so these are some of our good friends. Ah, that's Wesley. Here's our librarian as well. So a lot of good memories here, church at Cotterby, being given these Bibles. This is close to where the Bible translator Ezra Lawiri was murdered, killed in ambush. And we took in an evangelism explosion training team from James Kendi for the specific purpose of training them in evangelism explosion. We were bombed on Sunday morning. We were training chaplains and pastors and teachers in evangelism explosion. And we were equipping them with some great evangelistic tools like little DVD kits and video projectors and so on for film evangelism. After church, greeting the people, ministering there. Sunday morning, we'd just gone through the EE program and asked them, if you were to die today, do you know for sure that you're going to heaven? And the cry went up, Antonovs, and everyone went running out the church. Can you see how low the roof goes? The roof, there's no door. You just have to duck under the roof, sort of double over and get in. Now the thick thatch deadens the sound. So as everyone fled out, I was the last to leave the church. An aircraft flying over here doesn't mean you're the target. How many false alarms had I had? So I was taking my time getting out, you know, after you. And so I was the last to leave the church. And as I put my head out from under the thatch, I heard the high-pitched screams. And I remembered the words of my mother, who endured 62 aerial bombardments, 1,000 bomber raids in Berlin. My mom says, when the bombs are coming down, you hear the scream, you don't have time to get to the air shelter. All you can do is lie flat. And I did. I lay flat. I remembered my mom also saying, keep your mouth open and cover your ears if you can. You must keep your mouth open, because if you tense, which is the natural your eardrums will burst. You've got to equalize. So cover your ear if you can, but open your mouth, whatever you do. And I remembered that. And as I hit the ground, 5 of these 1,000-kilogram bombs, 2,200 pounds each, 5 of them exploded all within 100 meters of the church. And I'm lying flat on the ground when I took this picture from a lying position. And you can see some of the others diving into the trench. They're all on top of one another. There's so many people in the trench. Flames up. What went up came pummeling down. Well, I got up and I was quite disorientated and dazed, walking around to see if everyone was okay. And next thing, looked up and I could see the plane overhead. One, two, three dots, three more, and getting larger. Three more bombs that dropped right on top of us. So at this point, they dropped 8 1,000-kilogram bombs on us, all landed in a 100-meter area, so basically the size of a football field. And here you can see some of the shrapnel that landed close to us, and incredibly, no one was killed. No one was seriously injured. I had a few cracked ribs. In fact, I felt this piece of shrapnel come and whack against me. I thought it was shrapnel. I felt like someone had kicked me in the side, in my left side. And I thought that must be it, because how could you survive that? But it couldn't have been metal, because later when I got up and I brushed aside, couldn't see any blood. Felt sore, but it must have been a bark of tree or something solid that hit me, but couldn't have been metal, because there's no break of the skin. And sure enough, every time I laughed, sneezed, coughed for the next 6 weeks was real pain, agony. The physio said there's nothing you can do for cracked ribs. It'll take 6 weeks to heal. That's it. And sure enough, 6 weeks later was like, huh, no pain. This is great. But not only did we not lose anyone, we gained people. More people came to church after bombing than there were before. And the highlight of the service was presenting the Moral Bible, translated by Canon Ezra Weary, who lay buried not far from us. And as I was relating to them, do you realize the Bible is the greatest book in history? It's a message so important that some people hate the Bible so much are willing to kill to destroy it. The others who love the Word of God so much are willing to die to advance it. And here we were, so close from where the Bible translator lay buried. That relates to, do you know that William Tyndale, the man who translated the Bible into English, could not translate the Bible into English in England. He had to go to Germany, to Worms. And the Bibles, the first Bibles in English, had to be printed in Germany, smuggled through the Netherlands into England in bales of cotton. All 6,000 were intercepted by the Bishop of London and burned. There's only two copies of the original 6,000 New Testaments printed in English, done by William Tyndale. One of them was sold recently for £5.4 million, one New Testament. But as I related this, that how many people have died that we can have the religious freedom we enjoy? And what a service, 5-hour worship service. Here's Chaplain Moses and Chaplain John outside the church. The church building wasn't destroyed. People came from far and wide. And we've got some of the shrapnel that landed there on display in our cabinet in reception. We brought some back. Chaplains and soldiers from around came to see this church that was bombed and yet still stood. We continued and completed the week-long evangelism explosion training clinic the next week, and nobody left. There was a danger that bombers might come back, but the people stayed. Here's one of the trees blown over in the bombing. But as I said, the trees were full of shrapnel, but we were not. This officer said, this happened to show the power of God. Another man said, the Bibles of the Christians are more powerful than the bombs of the Muslims. And this is just one bomb that did not explode. On another occasion, another place, another time. But if it had exploded, it would have taken our compound church off the map. I wouldn't have dug this out, but the engineers came and they decided to dig it out. I said, why would you play with an unexploded bomb? They said, we need the explosives to give it back to the Arabs. I suppose it's more blessed to give than to receive. On this rock, Jesus said, I'll build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. Now, I haven't even got to New Mountainous. Let me stop at this point. Any questions, any comments at all? Yes?
Did you take most of the photos?
I took most of the photos. Not all, most. The vast majority.
A photo with a girl and a house.
I did not take that one. That's very, very disturbing. Yeah, oh, like, the photo of the girl with the vulture beyond. Well, that was the famous photo taken by Kevin Carter. I mean, yeah. Oh, were the people cutting? No, I was not. They wouldn't normally allow an outsider to be present for those kind of ceremonies. That's very much for the clan. I would be an unbeliever from their perspective. Yeah.
In Sudan, in the video about Sudan, there was a missionary, a frontline missionary there. Was he permanently in Sudan?
No, but he'd go in for 2 or 3 months at a time. When I was unmarried, I would do 4.5 month missions on my own. But once I got married, I tried to limit it to not more than 9 weeks away at a time. And now with all the responsibilities of a growing mission, I try not to be away for more than a month at a time. Most missions for me these days would be 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Obviously, I've got to cram more in smaller space because there's so much to juggle back here. But an overland mission was generally a 4.5 month mission. Driving up to Sudan could be 2 weeks. 3.5 weeks there, another 2 weeks coming back. Because obviously it wouldn't just be driving, it would be stopping ministry on the way and so on. So yes, an overland mission to Sudan was generally a 4.5 month operation. That's 8,000 kilometers, by the way, by road from Cape Town to Mundri, which is where our main mission base was. 8,000 Ks by road. Now, of course, if you just went from Cape Town as the crow flies up to Cairo, it's about 5,000 kilometers. But the roads don't go as the crow flies. The roads are very windy. So actually, it's 8,000 kilometers. Sorry, it's 8,000 kilometers from Cape Town to Cairo as a crow flies. But we've got to go 8,000 kilometers just to get to our mission base by road. Because the roads are not straight. One way. That's correct. So by the time you come back, you would have done 20,000 kilometers easily. Yeah. In fact, the last mission, which you, Toby, were on, was what, 15,000 kilometers? And you went to 7 countries, 15,000 Ks driving. Yeah, that gives you a bit of an idea. And the roads get worse the further north you go, basically. Any other comments or questions? Well, we've had people coming from Switzerland, Germany, Canada, Britain, South Africa. We've had people from Namibia. So we've had quite a variety of. We had a Nigerian missionary with us up in Sudan. I took an Elton up there. In fact, he was quite a character. So Elton, from Nigeria, he had been in the Nigerian Navy. He gets up there, and this one Sunday morning service, he starts to preach from a passage in Joshua. Kill them all! Men, women, children, kill them all! Kill the cattle, kill everything! I'm thinking, where's he going with this? And that's the whole message, and he ends off the sermon with, Viva Espile! So I said, Elton, this is meant to be a Bible sermon. What on earth do you mean, kill them all? He says, well, that's what the Arabs do to us. But we meant to have better standards than him. You're calling on him to be war criminals. We've got the Geneva Convention principles there that we're trying to give to the chaplains. This is not helping. And he's like, but the Arabs are doing atrocity. I said, I know that, but we're not to lower ourselves to their level. You meant to be representing the Lord here, mission. Well, I'm glad we didn't film that. It's not on sermon audio, but... And the local people liked his message. So some of our people, I think, forget who they're meant to be representing and get caught up in it. When we minister to rebels, we've got to bear in mind, we might be sympathetic to the cause, but, I mean, you can't go that way. I mean, that was just... But the Nigerians, of course, they've suffered a lot, the hands of Muslims. You think Boko Haram. So you can understand why he is agitated, but... Yeah, we've had quite a lot of our people go to... we ran a base there for many years, so it's not just one person. We've had dozens of our people based in Sudan, actually. Yes, well, that just was when the American filmmaker passed through, so he would have interviewed whoever was there at the time. Yeah. I think he went back to Switzerland.
Are they normally not that accurate, aeroplanes, the bombs?
No. Well, okay. If you haven't seen, have a look. On our veranda just outside reception, we've got a piece of shrapnel from one of the bombings. They dropped 100 bombs on a mission base in Sudan. And there's nothing else there. There's just Bishop Gwynne Bible College, a little clinic, and our church and chapel. I mean, that's it. There's nothing for kilometers around. So it must have been targeted. They came back 10 times. But you can see the shocking piece of workmanship, because a good bomb breaks into lots of small pieces. That is obviously bad engineering. That's not a smart bomb. That's a dumb bomb. And I'm not complaining. It's not that we want American smart bombs. It's not that we want precision weapons. I'm glad that our enemy is not efficient. But yes, they are super inaccurate, as you can see. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't be here. If we were facing some of the kind of technology they've got in the German army, we would have not done as well. I remember in all of my life, probably the most terrifying smuggling op I ever did was into East Germany through Checkpoint Charlie. Just terrifying, because the Stasi knew what they were doing. They were very efficient. The last thing about is an efficient enemy. It's wonderful when you're dealing with inefficient communists. I'm not complaining when they don't know their job and they're lazy, because that is definitely the biggest problem is efficiency. And fortunately up there, they might be vicious, but they're not accurate. And in fact, a lot of their bombs don't explode. There's a lot of unexploded bombs. I'm forgetting the amount right now, but we had quite a number of unexploded bombs on our mission base. If I remember right, it was 12 or 14 unexploded bombs. Unexploded bombs. Got a flag with a little red thing on there to warn people stay away from me, and children mustn't play there. So, and it'll take a long time for the engineers to get there. I was in one little village, Chukadum, where they had 54 unexploded bombs in this one village. I said, what is there in Chukadum that's worth bombing? Nothing much except that a big cross on top of the hillside. And I said, why do you have a big cross there? They said, we want the whole world to know. We are Christians. I asked if the Muslims bomb them, and I said, of course they do. So why do you have the cross up there? We want the whole world to know. We are Christians. So the mentality of the people there is very tenacious. You'll see they carry crosses. They put crosses on top of their huts and their churches. And of course, it's a red flag to Muslims. Muslims hate that.
Is Sudan as far north vehicle-wise that you sent on
a mission? We've never sent our vehicles higher than Sudan. That's right. That's the furthest north we've driven. When we've been in Nigeria, we've flown there, and then we might have driven in a borrowed vehicle, but it's not. We could not drive to Nigeria that I'm aware of. There's too many things to get over on the way. Might be physically possible, but as you know, the border officials wouldn't be as nice as the ones we were having here the other day. Yes?
You always carry your camera everywhere.
You know, I didn't always. And there have been times that a camera's been damaged, destroyed, confiscated, film's been confiscated. So I've lost some good pictures, but I always try to have... First mission I took to Mozambique. Didn't take a camera, had no pictures. And I remember giving a report back in Mozambique, and somebody said to me at a church up near Johannesburg, what you've got to say is very hard to believe. Next time, take pictures. And it was like it's a good piece of advice. I remember that. And so back then, the main thing I did was slides. Most of my pictures would be slides. Sometimes I'd put in black and white prints for a newsletter, but most times I'd have color slides. And now some of the pictures you can see don't look that good because we try to make a picture of a slide. Maybe our technology wasn't always good. Sometimes literally trying to, you've got your camera, you have a thing you slot in there and take a picture of a slide. Because to convert our slides is quite a job. We had a lot of slides. I've still got slides I haven't converted to print. And then there's a lot of prints we haven't digitized yet to this. Sometimes you can see some of the quality is a bit strange. And also some of the old developing ink maybe has faded. So it's we should have digitized earlier. Anyway, I have not gotten to the Nub Mountains. I'll get to more of that tomorrow night when we're going to be dealing with what can go wrong on a mission. And as you can imagine, quite a lot can go wrong on a mission. Any other questions before we close for tea? Yes, Cameron.
Any of the bombs explode before they hit the ground?
Praise God, no.
Really? It would be far worse than that.
Yes. A ground burst goes in, bursts up and out. If you're lying flat, you might survive even fairly close to a bomb. An air burst, you know, imagine if it's designed to burst, say, 10 meters off the ground. Now it comes down. Where's there to hide? Even in a even trench. So those are very, very nasty little things. Yes, the air bursts are the things we hate. When I was trying to get into a trench and there was no trench for the second bombing at the church, Jumba, and I saw us next to this massive tree and I thought I should move, but I knew not a wise idea to move because you're more likely to get hit while moving and standing than if you're lying flat. But if that bomb was detonated in any one of the branches of this tree, there'd be no protection from an air burst. And sure enough, the bomb went straight through the tree. Smash, 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 smash. Took branch after branch out, but it didn't explode until it buried itself in the ground and then came up. And in fact, I think we've got a picture. There we go. This is the tree. There's the church. I was just on the other side of it there, buried in here. That's just a piece of shrapnel. We brought some of the shrapnel back in a reception. Oh, if it hit the tree, then none of us would have survived. No, I mean, an airburst is just devastating. Now, of course, the sadists who plan these technologies these days, they've got all these horrible little cluster bombs and what have you, and precision guard weapons. And you do not want to be the target of advanced Western weaponry. The kind of things they've gotten, it's mean. I would not... I wouldn't be here today if the Arabs had been that efficient. The kind of things that they've got in NATO is not the sort of weapons we'd want to face.
Do you think that perhaps it's been purposely kept out of their hands?
Oh, no, I'm sure. No, I'm sure it's been kept out of their hands. I would trust that the West's trying to keep their highest type of precision weapons out of the hands of gangsters like these. Let's face it, The Hague wants Omar al-Bashir as a war criminal on trial. And do you know, he comes for medical treatment to South Africa every now and then, and the South African High Court has ordered the government to serve the papers on him and arrest him, because The Hague, we're part of Interpol. We've signed the anti-genocide treaty, and they want Omar al-Bashir, one of the most wanted war criminals in the world, for genocide. And now, the South African government should have arrested him when he came here, but they didn't. And the highest court in the land of South Africa ordered the Zuma government to arrest Omar al-Bashir. They didn't. I mean, that's how lawless our ANC government is here. And we've had Colonel Mengistu, the genocidal lunatic who was destroying Ethiopia. He comes here regularly for medical treatment. He lives in Zimbabwe under protection of ZANU. And if Mengistu comes here, he should be arrested. Again, they've never arrested him. So this government is an accessory to these war crimes.
Who
funds the communists? Well, that's a nice story. But, well, sorry to say, but a lot of the bankers who you thought were capitalists in the West are actually funding the communists. We've got some books in our shelves, like The Best Enemy Money Can Buy, written by Sutton, and Wall Street and the Riot and the Bolshevik Revolution. And so basically, there's a bunch of very... Do you know that George Soros, for example, a Hungarian billionaire, not only funds the ANC, but even the DA. We're talking about billions of rands. Billions. With a B. And George Soros funds the Antifa, who go around acting as terrorists in America, and a lot of the Islamic invasion of Europe. And so the Rothschilds, the Oppenheimers, the George Soros. So some of the richest capitalists in the world are funding the communists. Yes. It makes it a little confusing. What do they get out of it? They get a lot of power. So, for example, if you look at how well the world was working before 1914, Christians ruled the world, gospel was going forth everywhere, people being converted phenomenally, and the First World War turned everything upside down and basically crippled Christendom and got the Christians to kill one another by the millions. And as a result, Bolshevism arose, Soviet Union took over the Russian Empire, and one of the greatest Christian countries was turned into an atheistic hellhole, and then they got more and more. Now, what does this do? Debt, weapons, war, disruption, and as a result, the United Nations, the Soviet Union, so many other things have risen up. Christianity's gone down since the world wars, and atheism, communism, materialism's gone up. The globalist agenda's being advanced. So you take, for example, one American mega capitalist, Armand Hammer. He could fly to the Soviet Union any time during the Cold War and walk straight into Joseph Stalin's Dacha, his holiday home, and into his bedroom, into his office, no problem. Where no Russian could do that. He didn't need to get prior permission to fly into Russian airspace, land in Moscow airport. Now, this is one of the top capitalists in America, and yet he had a great relation with him. You get many of the factories in the Soviet Union were actually built, funded, set up by American capitalists, industrialists. The T-34 tank was designed by the Americans and given to the Russians, one of the best tank designs of the Second World War. It's an American design provided to the Russians by America free. Didn't even sell to them. And then they gave them trillions of dollars worth of weapons through Lend-Lease during the Second World War. So there's so many weird things. The Americans in Vietnam were fighting terrorists who were being funded by the Soviet Union, being driven by Ford trucks that were made in the Urals in Russia with American capital, American industry, American everything. And so basically, Americans were funding both sides of the war, and their men were being attacked and killed by terrorists being transported by their own trucks that have been provided to the Soviet Union. So there's a lot of things that are very, very, very disturbing. But then again, in South Africa, when Nelson Mandela became president, a year later, 1995, Harry Oppenheimer, the richest person in South Africa, he's to South Africa what Rothschild is to America. And Harry Oppenheimer put a full page article in the Star, Daily Mail, and so on. We said, this is what we've worked for. Since 1961, Anglo-American, which is his organization, the biggest diamond magnet company in the world, Anglo-American has worked to bring the ANC to power in South Africa and to bring down National Party. Now, this isn't somebody's conspiracy theory. This is Harry Oppenheimer, the richest man in South Africa, saying that he worked to bring this about. The second richest man in South Africa is Rupert, Anton Rupert. Now it's a son, but when Anton Rupert back in the 60s claimed that he was working to bring down Hendrik Verwoerd, and when Hendrik Verwoerd was assassinated, Rupert said that, you know, this is the best thing that happened. And the newspaper, we've gotten a book on Hendrik Verwoerd, our prime minister at the time, who got South Africa out of debt. South Africa didn't owe anyone a cent, and then they assassinated him. And the book on Hendrik Verwoerd, we've had the author here speaking at our Reformation Society. He said that Anton Rupert, there's newspapers even, I think he's got the picture of it, Anton Rupert declaring war on the Prime Minister of South Africa because of what he's doing to fight communism and getting us out of debt, a country. We were having 8% growth rate a year. These days people get hysterically excited for 2% growth rate a year. He was on 8% growth rate every year, and even more sometimes. And here the top capitalists in this country waged war, and from the look of it, actually bankrolled the assassination of our Prime Minister, Hendrik Verwoerd. So the Ruperts and the Oppenheimers openly boast that they worked to destroy the previous government and bring in the present government. So you've got traitors, communist traitors. Why would a capitalist want to be a communist? Because under capitalism, real free enterprise, there's competition. That's dangerous. But under communism, all you got to do is pay off the dictator, the one party, and you've got it all. So, for example, Harry Oppenheimer owned the mines in Zambia, and they didn't get a wage increase for the whole time of independence under Kaunda. And when the people tried to strike, out went the police or something, shot the workers, and Everyone went back to work, except the ones who got shot. And as so they didn't have to worry about safety regulations, caring for the people, because it's a communist country. They're just paid off Kahunda and UNIP. And so you've got these big multinational groups like Anglo-American, or, well, there's quite a few like that, De Beers. And they find it better to have a dictator to deal with. It's cheaper than to have a free enterprise system where there can be competition. So when we speak about monopoly capitalism, that's evil. If you're talking about free enterprise, that's good. Free enterprise is good, socialism is bad, but monopoly capitalism is almost as bad as socialism. I mean, like, what's the difference? I think in America, how many farms did America have before the Depression? Something like 600,000 farms. And today, about how many farm owners would there be in America? Yes. So America's gone. America's more than doubled its population since the 1930s. But the number of farm owners is down to something like 1/6 what it was back when the population was a third of what it is today. So what you've got is less and less farms owned by less and less people. And many of the people who are farmers in these lands are actually tenant farmers. They don't own it, and a corporation owns it, and the people are basically working for a company. So the family farm, owned by the family, is becoming rare. Even in South Africa, I wonder how many of our farms are owned by a family and how many are owned by a corporation.